Okay, I'm pulling out of my driveway.
We all know what that means.
It's time for another episode of Drive to Make Theros, the podcast that seemingly will not end. Anyway, for the last six podcasts, not consecutively, but this is the seventh podcast dedicated to Theros. And all of the, I'm doing card-by-card stories, talking about different stories from Theros and exploring the design. I've been doing an experiment trying to do a more recent set. And what I've learned is I have a lot more stories because I remember them all. So I should tell more stories about like, Tempest. Because, what was Tempest? I don't remember. Anyway, that was my old man voice. That was a very bad old man voice. I do actually do a decent old man voice. That was not it. So, okay. Last we left, where were we at? We were at 100-handed one. Okay, so 100-handed one is a Hecaton Harris. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I can spell it, but I cannot pronounce it. Okay, so when Ethan made his little book about Theros, and it listed all the things that magic had done that fell into Greek mythology and all the things it hadn't done, one of the things he listed on the hadn't done is a 100-handed one. Okay, so for those that know the Greek mythology, the 100-handed ones were these creatures that helped the gods overthrow the Titans, Zeus and company. I think it aided them in overthrowing the Titans, but then they imprisoned them because they were powerful and they were worried that they'd overthrow them, I believe. Anyway, I'm not 100% on this one, but anyway, they were creatures of mighty power. They were huge. Ethan definitely wanted to do 100-handed ones, and I was fine. So one of the things I've explained before is one of our philosophies with top-down nowadays is that you have to think about rarity with how what kind of resonant thing you want. And what we've learned is common should be something that people just know. So in Greek mythology, look, common's going to be satyrs and centaurs and cyclops and, you know, things that just you're familiar with. You know what they are, you know, minotaurs and such. And the idea is that as you get higher in rarity, you can get a little more obscure. And the idea is that it's fine to sort of dig deep and give a reward to the people that really know the source material. Just you got to do that at a higher rarity, not a lower rarity. Like the lesson of Kamigawa was some of that obscure stuff was done at lower rarities, and people are like, "What?" You know. And at a higher rarity, they still go, "What?" But the as fan of "What" is much lower. And it's fun every once in a while to learn something, you know. But it's not as much fun. It's, when the basic things aren't there, it's harder for you to latch on. You know, if you, what we want when you first open a top-down set is that the commons are just, oh, it's this, and oh, it's that, and just you recognize things. And so what you want to do is take the things that aren't so recognizable and use them as a spice, you know, at a higher rarity so they show up. And I think 100-handed one, so the other thing with 100-handed one, so the story of it is, originally, it didn't have monstrosity. But we're like, oh, once we realize the monstrosity thing, we're like, of course it's got to have monstrosity. It's a giant monster. And white, so one of the things we had done with monstrosity was we had chosen to put it mostly in red and green. And so red and green have monstrosity in common. They have the most, you know, the quantity and quality is higher. And the idea was that everybody had a little bit of monsters, but white was the least monstrous. White just has the least big creatures. At lower rarities, it mostly has tiny things, and it was going to be more the human color and the army color, and you know it had a role to play in the set, but it really wasn't going to be the monster color. But we wanted to make sure at high rarities we had a few monsters, and the 100-handed one seemed good as a white monster. So what happened was we made the card. I think the original version, before it had monstrosity, was it could block any number of creatures. I think Ethan made that version. And the idea is, okay, it's a big monster, it can block whatever you like. That was the original version. A big monster, it can block as many as it wants to. And then I think we decided with monstrosity that we'd make the can block anything, the monstrosity part of it. So the idea is, I'm big, I can get bigger, and when I get bigger, my extra abilities, I now can block anything. Because that was, like, the key to monstrosity is you want to sort of you know, build into something cool. And so the end state, the coolest thing, which is what where Ethan started, was, okay, giant monster that can black as many creatures as one. It's pretty cool, you know, it serves as this, until you get through this thing, you're not going to get to the player, and it can block everything. So what happened was, I think the original version was, I don't remember the size, but it was whatever size, you do monstrosity, it gets some counters, and now it can block everything. And we were in a meeting, and somebody, I don't remember who, I would give credit if I remember who it was, said, well, shouldn't it be it can block 99 more things? And we laughed, and we laughed, and then I'm like, okay, we're using that. Because one of the things that's very important in any Magic set, but top-down sets especially, is that you want to find mechanics that sort of have a little bit of novelty in expressing flavor. And the reality is, you know, the 99 plus is just cute in the sense that I'm sure there'll be games in which it matters that it can only block 100 things, but, you know, we thought it was kind of neat that, you know, that the 99 plus was just a flavorful way to say what we wanted to say that just had a little extra oomph to it. And one of the things that's funny, we've gone on this path. Early Magic was all about that. Just, like, write whatever makes the card the coolest it could be. And there was a lack of consistency, which was a lot of cards in Alpha didn't all work the same, even though they were similar, because each card kind of handled the problems individually. And then what happened was with time, like, okay, we need to consolidate that. We don't want cards working almost the same way. Cards need to work the same way. So we went to the other end of the spectrum, which is like, no novelty text, no trinket text, no, you know, let's cut to the bone. What does the card do? And then eventually we came back around saying, okay, you know, we got to be careful. We want to be consistent, but that doesn't mean that we can't use trinket text. So trinket text, by the way, there's novelty text and trinket text, which are slightly different things. I will define. Trinket text is something that adds flavor to the card that really in gameplay is not going to matter most of the time. You know, a good example is you have a knight with protection from dragons. Well, how often is a knight going to even be able to, like, first of all, dragons fly and the knight doesn't fly. Like, how in the world is it going to matter? Now, hey, there's some dragons that have direct damage effects that, you know, can activate to damage things. Oh, they can't hurt the knight. You know, I mean, it's not that it never comes up, but hey, having a knight with protection from dragons has a very cool flavor to it. We call that trinket text. It doesn't matter much, but it adds something. So novelty text is a 100-handed one. So novelty text says, okay, we wanted the creature to block any number of creatures. Well, blocking 99 additional creatures is functionally very similar to blocking any number, but it has more novelty to it, that it just reads funnier. You know, if the card existed and just said block any number, that card's not as cool as block 99 extra. And so novelty text means that it doesn't tend to change the functionality. It just takes the functionality that exists and puts it in a fun way. The other example of that, although this one didn't actually come, was Door to Nothing, that Aaron and I originally had wanted it to destroy target player rather than they lose the game. I think we wanted to destroy target creature or player. And the reality is, it's very similar to target player loses the game, but it just felt cooler. You know, destroy target creature or player felt cooler than target player loses the game. You know, cause we've done target player loses the game a lot, and we've never done destroy target player. You know, plus creature or player is kind of cute. Anyway, that is novelty text, and that is what the 100-handed one is up to. Next, Hythonia the Cruel. The Cruel! Okay, so this started... So Hythonia the Cruel and with Keepsake Gorgon... started in the set. Keepsake Gorgon was Baby Gorgon, and Hypotheon the Cruel, Hythonia the Cruel, was Mama Gorgon. And neither of them was legendary when we made them originally. So the original version of the card was they both had Death Touch, because they're Gorgons. Baby Gorgon, its monstrous ability, or monstrosity ability, it was called monstrous in a design. So if I say monstrous, I'm thinking monstrosity. Its monstrosity effect was destroy target creature, which I think it still is. Mama Gorgon had this cutesy thing where it did one damage to everything in play. And the reason that was cutesy was it had death touch, so that meant its damage would have death touch, which meant it killed everything. And development rightfully said, okay, stop being so cutesy. It just destroys everything. Let me talk about non-Gorgon. I've joked a lot. If you've seen me in an interview at the Pro Tour and at on my column about how I did non-Gorgon because I wanted to create our own world of Greek mythology where Gorgon's new love. In the actual Greek mythology, Gorgons affected each other. It was a punishment. It was not meant to be something great. The fact that nobody could look at them without dying, even other Gorgons, you know, that the point of the curse was it isolated them. When nobody can look at you, it's very hard to have a relationship with somebody. So there's two reasons I did not grow. One is, you know, I wanted our Gorgons to know love. But the mechanical reason, there's actually a mechanical reason, which is that by putting non-Gorgon on Hythonia, I was making a Gorgon tribal card. And what that meant is, oh, well, I have a card that kills everything except Gorgons. Oh, well, you know what will go well in that deck? Other Gorgons. And so, for example, Keepsake Gorgon goes well with Hythonia, because if you have Keepsake Gorgon in play and then play Hythonia, well, guess what? You kill everything except both of them. They both remain. And so it was a way to add a little bit of a Gorgon tribal. There's not a lot of Gorgons in the set, but Magic has enough Gorgons that, look, you can use Hythonia to make a Gorgon deck. Okay, so how does Hythonia become legendary? So this story is a cute one. So what happens is we get the art in. So Jeremy Jarvis is the art director for Magic. He does an awesome job. One of the things Jeremy does is when art comes in, he picks the best art, what we call tier one art. And the reason is we pick images that we want to use for marketing and for, you know, like as we're trying to sell the set, like, oh, these are the best images. Let's use these images, you know. And Hythonia was one of the tier one images. And Creative finally said, oh, this is so awesome. We really want to use this in a lot of places. Oh, this seems so awesome. This can't be a generic Gorgon. This has to be a specific Gorgon. Like, she looks awesome. And so Creative came to development, I think, at the time, and said, guys, do you mind if we make this legendary? And development's like, oh, no problem. It's very powerful. Fine. You know, legendary is fine. And so we made it legendary at Creative's request, because, like, the art was so awesome. They're like, we want to make this a character. They were inspired by the art to make it a character. Next, we have Kragma Warcaller. So this is a black-red card. It gives haste and +2/+0 to Minotaurs. Okay, so one of the questions that I get about this card is, hey, wait a minute. Grants haste and +2/+0. Red could do that. And my answer to that is, why is it black-red? Red can do that. And the answer is, black can do that too. Black can also give +2/+0 and haste. So one of the things we do, when we talk about gold cards, there's a bunch of different types of gold cards that we can do. I did a podcast, I believe, on gold cards. One of the things is the intersection where you find something that both colors can do, and then you give it at a bargain price, because multicolor costs are harder to get than a simple cost. So if I have a card that costs 2B or costs 2R, I can get a spell that costs 1BR that does more than either 2B or 2R can do. And so what happened was, we wanted to make this a black-red card because there's a cycle of uncommon cards that are encouraging different draft strategies. And this card is meant to be, I open this pack one, pick one, pack one, that I want to go, ooh, I'm going to go Minotaurs. And then it's setting you up, and it's red and black, and it says to draft black Minotaurs and red Minotaurs, and lines everything up. And so we really wanted this to be something that sort of sent you down that path. Also, we knew Minotaurs were going to be fun. We had put them in black and red in the set, and we wanted to make sure that if you're going to make a Minotaur deck, that we definitely encourage you to play red and black. Now, note, we made a rare mono-red Minotaur lore that if you wanted to make go bigger than just a set and make a mono-red Minotaur, we gave you a very good Minotaur red and mono-red. That's not for limited, so we put it at rare. Once again, when you look at rarities, like I said, I'll do a podcast on rarities one of these days. Rarities have a lot to do with limited, and so if something is meant for limited, it either goes to common or uncommon, and if it's not meant for limited, it goes at rare or mythic rare. Every once in a while, it's not meant for limited and goes at lower rarities for complexity reasons, but usually if it goes there, it's something that can work in limited. It causes a problem for limited, we always get it out of uncommon, or common and uncommon. Okay, next, Labyrinth Champion. Oh, so this is the heroic. So this is a guy who has heroic shock, meaning when you target him, he shocks something. He does 2 damage to a creature player. We had him in common originally. So we decided early on, or I don't know, middle of the way on, that we wanted white and green to have heroic that makes them bigger, and white would have small effects. White would get the small plus one, like a single plus one counter plus a small effect, where green would get more plus one counters. And blue and red were going to be more spell-oriented, where white and green were a little more creature-oriented. Black kind of cut the difference. And so we wanted blue and red to have a little more like, I generate a spell when I target it. And so one of the obvious spells... So one of the things, by the way, is every year we have new mechanics. And every time we do a new mechanic, the very first place we look to in red is damage. Now, I explained this, I think, in the red podcast, that I think damage is thought of, grouped together as like one thing, when really it does a whole bunch of different functions, and red uses it very useful. It's has a lot of functions that you can use it for. Obviously, when we're thinking about heroic, and wanting red, and wanting spell effect, shock, you know, direct damage made sense. This one got moved around a little bit, ended up going uncommon because we have a rule in New World Order that says if you're capable of killing multiple creatures, you get red flagged, which means you have to justify yourself at common. So usually a card capable of killing more than one creature is not at common, and this thing is. So I think we had it at common for a day or two, and they're like, oh, yeah, okay, it's uncommon. We moved it uncommon. I do enjoy, by the way, that separating heroic things that make themselves better versus heroic things that generate effects just make very different style of decks and play differently. And one of the things that's very important is when you make a mechanic, trying to get breadth to the mechanic. Like, the thing I like about heroic is, you know, while the trigger's the same, different kind of heroics work very differently. How you'll do things, it just, you know, it's a very different animal from I want to build this up to I want to sort of, you know, use it as to build the deck around, and the shock one or the draw cards. And there's certain heroic ones that really let you sort of craft a deck if you're willing to do that. Okay, next, Lightning Strike. So, okay, Lightning Strike threw me a little bit. So when the set comes out, I have a blog, for those that are unaware, called Blogatog. It's on Tumblr. And I answer questions. I also post my comic there, and I post my podcast there, and I post my my columns there. But the biggest thing I do there is I answer questions. And so one of the first things that happened is I started getting all these questions about Lightning Strike. Lightning Strike? Why wasn't this Searing Spear? And I was a little taken aback, mostly because it's a common. And, it, you know, I understand when we take a card that's a valuable card that people have, you know, you have a rare, mythic rare, and we just reprint it but change the name. Okay, now it's annoying. You have these cards. Now you got to go and get other versions of these cards. And I understood that, but I felt like it kind of was like, oh, you're going to open four of these. Just an opening, you know, you get a box, you're probably going to open four of these. I didn't think it was that big a deal. In fact, I didn't even think it was that big a deal. So we're like, why are people so upset by this? And what I come to realize is that it's the principle of the thing. I think what happens is, we do something that's upsetting, and then we do it enough that, like, it's not that this one's really that upsetting. It's not that hard to get four Lightning Strikes, but it's kind of the principle of the thing. Like, we had just done a Searing Spear as a some sort of promo, I believe, an old art promo. People are like, ooh, I got this old art promo. I want to use it. Oh, the exact card exists, but I can't use it. Message heard. It's something for me. I didn't realize how that is something that people were as touchy about as they are, which is important for me to understand, because if something concerns you guys, I want to address it. And so, okay, I mean, that's very important, and it's why I have my blog to learn things like this. So let me explain how it happened, because as you will see, there was never an opportunity to be Searing Spear, and I'll explain why. So what happened is we had a spell. I don't remember what the spell did, but it was a direct damage spell, and I assume it had some of the mechanics of the set or something, as we normally do. And so it got concepted as Lightning Strike, and we got, you know, Lightning Bolt. We knew we wanted a Lightning Bolt-like spell. I mean, Lightning Bolt we did not want to bring back. We talked about it, but it's very powerful, and it warps the environment. It causes all sorts of design issues. And I'm not saying we'll never reprint Lightning Bolt again, but it's not something we want to do a lot. And we've done it, I mean, in the big picture, we did it relatively recently. I know it's been a few years, but it's not something we want to run all that often. It's supposed to be very infrequently. So we knew we wanted to do a lightning spell, and so we made this, you know, creative, like, you know, Jen was doing the card count, something, oh, direct damage spell, okay, good, good. It's, you know, I mean, we can't call it lightning bolt, but lightning strike, you know, it's because the gods throw the lightning. And then what happened was the card turned out to be too good. And development figured it out late enough that they didn't want to mess around with making a new card. So what happens when development needs to change a card late in the process, the normal thing they'll do is they'll change it to a card that's already existing. And the reason for that is it's an understood thing. You know, Lightning Strike, for example, and the Lightning Strike, Searing Spear is a card that development understands the power level of is. It's a card that actually means something to constructed, but in a way that's not scary to them, that they know, you know. And so it was a late enough change that they said, okay, we need to change to a known thing. Now, they wanted to change to Searing Spear. The problem is it was so late in the process that the art was already done for Lightning Strike. You know, there's a guy throwing a lightning bolt. Like, well, that's what the art is. And so Searing Spear didn't make any sense. It wasn't a spear. It wasn't on fire. The art didn't make any sense for Searing Spear. So the answer was, okay, it's a common. Look, we'll just give it a new name. And so they ended up saying, okay, we'll do Searing Spear, but we'll have to change the name. But it's not as if they knew the whole time they were doing Searing Spear and just changed the name. It was out of the necessity of trying to fix the problem. And so, if they decided to repeat Searing Spear and just change it for the sake of changing it, I understand maybe the people would be upset, but I'm trying to stress that that wasn't the case. Something happened. They didn't want to break the environment. And so all the reasons behind it were very rational, sound reasons, but it did end up resulting in a Searing Spear duplicate that's not called Searing Spear. So anyway, it does now allow us a little flexibility. It is an ability we want to use a lot. And sometimes fire makes sense, and sometimes lightning makes sense. So it gives a little flexibility to match our world in the future, and I think that is good. Lothum Kettlebleepus. So Kettlebleepus, a real short story here, was also like Hippocamp, where Ethan really wanted to do it. And it just was another one. Just I'm trying to show. One of the things that when I try to do these stories is the idea that there's context and there's ongoing things that are happening, and that one of the most important things about being on a design team, or when I look for designers, I look for skill. That's very important. But another thing that is also equally important is part of being on a creative team is spending a lot of time in a small room with these people. That you want people that make the process fun and entertaining. And so we goof around a lot just because part of the creative process is being light and loose and having fun. And so one of the running jokes of our things was Ethan was just trying to get, he had a short list. He wanted a 100-handed one. He wanted a Kettlebleepus. He wanted a Hippocamp. And I used it to tease him. I mean, not that I didn't want that. Not that we didn't label those things. Not that we didn't encourage him to do that. But it just was a running joke, you know, where he was in charge of the file. And if I didn't name something, he could name it. And so, you know, he would come in and go, okay, it's a roaring Kettlebleepus. And the joke is he would say this, and I go, really, Ethan? Really? Kettlebleepus? And we would joke. Anyway, it was a running joke. It was funny. I mean, the thing I'm hoping when I talk about some of these stories is realize that, look, you know, I want to get some of the humanity behind, you know, like, these are people making the sets, you know, and I'm a big believer of trying to share who we are, and that we're not just, you know, the man behind the curtain making stuff. That we are people, you know, and anyway, I will move on. Miss Cutter Hydra. If I asked you, I mean, Aaron did a little question answered at the last Pro Tour. So if you weren't there, for those that might not know the answer to this question, what did this card, what Greek trope did Miss Cutter Hydra start as? And the answer is Hercules. And you're like, what? And the answer was, we had Hercules, we wanted to do Hercules. So the original version of Hercules, like, I don't, needed, like, some number of enchantments on it. It was trying to match the labors of Hercules, and, like, it needed 7 enchantments, but Hercules had 12 labors. It didn't make sense. It was just impossible to play, and getting 7 auras on something was crazy, so we changed it. We came up with a card that I liked a lot, so much I like a lot that I'm going to make the card, so I'm not going to tell you what the card did. But it did something that, on the surface, see, it was one of those things where, so I'll say this. It was a 12-12 for not a lot of mana, and it had a restriction. And the restriction was not, I mean, it, the restriction seemed easier to overcome than it was. But it was this neat restriction that you really, like, were challenged to beat the restriction. And the problem was two things. One is, creative didn't like having Hercules be a 12-12. We were tying a bunch of stuff together, and we were trying to make him the most powerful human, you know, ever. Because he was, oh my god, he's super powerful. And but we had a big fight about how big he was supposed to be. And then the ability, which we really liked, that I thought played well, development did not like at all. And the god book, the god book poll, it didn't fare that. In the rare poll, it didn't fare that well. It's an internal thing. We asked people in the building what they think of it. It didn't do that well. And so at some point, they realized they needed a card that had to fit developmental purposes. And so what they did is, they're like, okay, we need a green card we can turn in this function that, you know, I think they were worried about, I think it was Delver, something blue. And so they needed to scrap a card to make a green card that was good against this particular archetype. And the team didn't like this card. I tried to save this card. In fact, they tried to kill it multiple times, and I, like, came to the card's defense. Usually as a lead designer, I will jump in once in a while on a few cards that I really think matter. I felt this mattered. I really wanted it. At some point, it got changed from Hercules to Hydra because the creative team didn't think it could be Hercules. So I'm like, fine, it's not Hercules. But I like the card mechanics. I said, fine, it could be Hydra. And they got art for Hydra in, so when they needed to change things, it was late enough that they couldn't change the art. So they ended up deciding they wanted to use the Hydra. And so my card, the team's card, actually, went bye-bye. So I will try to some other day, one day when Hercules shows up. I mean, this card, not necessarily Hercules. I'll tell you. Next is Nessian Courser. So Nessian Courser was a card in Future Sight. So one of the things that happened in Future Sight was I was aware as I was designing Future Sight that it was getting a little complicated. For those unaware, it is the most complicated set in the history of complicated sets. And so one of my ideas was I was trying to figure out how to do future shifted cards that could have a new frame that felt like they made sense in the future shifted frame but weren't complicated. So one idea we came up with was full frame commons. Vanilla. Full frame common vanillas. And the idea was, oh, it's a special frame, so the reason it's future shifted is, ooh, the frame, it's a full art vanilla, because vanillas don't need a text box opposite, they're vanillas. And so we made a series of vanillas. We also went to the development team, or maybe the developer on the design team, and said, what are vanillas we've never made? And trying to make some new vanillas and push in some places, and we made a few powerful vanillas. But anyway, Creative had the world as their oyster to one of the things Creative was doing during Future Sight was showing, they were looking at future worlds. Like, here's a hint of places we might go. So on this card, it was a centaur, so they made it like a Greek-inspired world. And that was the little nod in Future Sight that, you know, one day we might do a Greek mythological-inspired world. So when it came time to do the set, whenever we do a set, we always look at Future Sight and say, oh, is there a Future Sight card that makes sense here? When it does, we try to use it. We don't always use it. We're not slave to Future Sight. But when we find opportunities, we look. And I realized that this card was a perfect fit here. The name was made to match the world. You know, Nessian has roots in Greek, has Greek roots, I believe. Anyway, so we knew this was a perfect place. Obviously, we don't reprint art on new sets, so we knew it would have a new piece of art. But we're like, oh, this is a very cool place. I then teased that there was a Future Sight card. In retrospect, I guess I made a mistake. I think the problem was that I set up expectations for a crazy Future Sight Future Shift card, and we got a very plain Future Sight Future Shift card. So I think I made a mistake of expectations. I'm not sure what I should have done, but anyway, I like sort of teasing guys as thing, but I think when I tease you, I have to be careful not to lead you. Like, normally I lead you down the path of, you know, it's a 12-12 creature that costs one mana, 12-12 trampler that costs one mana. But I think when people read that, they have expectations that, okay, of course there's a drawback. How else could you have a 12-12 trample for one? Where this, people were just expecting the world, and they got a little unhappy when I didn't give them the world. So, a mistake on my part. Nykthos, Shrine de Nyx. I have no idea what accent that was. So this card started as a top-down card. Basically, what happened was, we wanted to make a temple, because the temples were very big. And the idea was, oh, it's a temple to the gods. And so one of the ideas we had was, oh, well, if it's a temple to the gods, oh, well, let's make use of devotion because it's a temple. And then the cleanest idea of devotion is, oh, we'll do a devotion, something that helps your mana. It's a land. So, like, okay, we'll you know, cross. Temple has to be land. Devotion makes sense to temple. Mana is tied to land. You know, we all mixed together, and we ended up with Nykthos. When we made it, we had no idea it was going to be the powerhouse it's become. I'm not sure if development tweaked its numbers or not. I do know that, like I said, it's funny when you make a card that ends up being this, you know, tournament staple, and really, we're just trying to make a top-down temple. Our goal was not lofty. It was just, I mean, it was lofty, but it wasn't, we weren't trying to make a powerful card. We were just trying to make a flavorful card. And it ended up being, I mean, I love, by the way, when the super flavorful cards happen to be good tournament cards. I think that's cool. It's neat. I'm happy devotion is showing up and constructed like it is, in the sense that here's this mechanic that I really wanted people to love, and now that it's getting played, I think people are really falling in love with it, that Chroma never really got quite this reception, so I'm happy for that. Okay, Polukranos. Okay, so Polukranos, so the card was originally called Phytohydra, and when you used the Monstrosity, it said, it fights all creatures! And that's one of the things, that one of the luxuries of being in design is you can just write words. You can write words that sound like they make sense. But at some point, somebody has to look at those words and go, you know what, that doesn't actually work. We try to have that happen during design. Sometimes the rares and the mythics will fall through only because we spend a lot more time on the mechanics, the things that happen a lot to make sure that all that stuff works, because if any one card can't work, it's easy to change, but if the whole mechanic doesn't work, that can undermine your set significantly. So it turns out Polukranos couldn't fight everything. Eric did the best job he could to try to retain the general essence of it. I'm a little sad in that I'm not the biggest fan of green doing damage to creatures. It does have a little bit of a fight feel, so I can justify it in my head, I guess. It's a little sad to me that it can't fight everything. I thought that was awesome. The other thing, I guess, that what was one of Eric's issues, which is a very strong issue, is it tended to destroy lots of creatures but always die, and it's like you kind of want to have this cool creature in play, and so that's true. You want this giant creature in play. So as I explained earlier today, the monstrosity, the monsters we ended up putting, focusing in red and green, the idea being if you're drafting, that red and green is where the monstrosity deck, the monster deck, is going to be. There's monsters in other colors. I believe black was next in line for monsters, and that blue and white had the least amount of monsters. I think the way it worked was white was the least. So green was the most, then red, then black, then blue, then white, as my memory. That's how it played out. That white didn't make a lot of sense for monsters. Blue had some serpents and things, so blue had a little more sense for monsters. Black had all the gorgons, and it had plenty of things that made a lot of sense there, so... and then red and green were, you know, very the monster colors, and they're the colors that are common, have a little bit bigger thing, especially green. That is Polukranos. Okay, I have now arrived at Wizards. So I need to wrap this up. I finished almost another column, all but one, but I guess next time, I'll be able to finish off with one more. Maybe next time I'll have to pick up the pace. I got up to pee, though. So next time you join me, I will finish off P and hopefully get through the rest of the alphabet. One of the big tests that we will discover with this set of podcasts is how many podcasts on a topic is too many podcasts? I'm not sure. But anyway, we are testing the waters. It's on something that I know you guys like, is me talking about actual design stuff. So I'm hoping this is something people like. Hopefully not every future thing will be this long. I think this was a byproduct of me just being recent, so I know it in my head very, very well. Anyway, as always, I love talking design. I love talking Theros. I'm very, very proud of Theros. I'm part of many sets that I've done, but Theros definitely was one of the ones that everything lined up, and really it shines, and I feel like in the last couple of years I've done some of my best work. Innistrad and Theros are two of my best sets I've ever done, and I'm really happy about that. It's funny that they're both top-down. I believe one of the things that I've been experimenting, you guys will see this in upcoming years, is trying to do some stuff that's not top-down, that invests a lot of how we're doing design now in a different way. I want to use fifth-age design, things other than top-down, only because we can't do top-down every year. There's only so many things that make sense with top-down. And you want to mix up anyway. Magic is best when we mix things up. So anyway, thank you very much for listening to me go on and on and on and on about Theros. But I guess it's time for me to be making magic. Talk to you next time, guys.